Today on This Week in Iowa, 2 years since the COVID-19 shutdowns, how our industries are recovering from the pandemic. Then the shooting at East High School leaves officials asking, how do we stop the violence? And we're taking a look at daylight saving time, why we might not ever fall back again. Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for being with us here for This Week in Iowa. I'm Sabrina Ahmed. It's been 2 years since the world shut down, including right here in Iowa. 2 years to the week, in fact. On March 17th, 2020, businesses closed. People working from home or not working at all. Gatherings limited to 10 people. At first, we thought maybe a few days, then a few weeks. Iowa's government-mandated shutdown lasted 6 weeks. After that, week by week, Governor Reynolds slowly lifted restrictions. By the end of May of 2020, all businesses were back open. But that was really just the beginning of the struggles that they would face. But it's not just the restaurant industry that we've heard so much about struggling. It's all sectors in Iowa, their own separate sets of issues. So joining us this morning are Perla DeLuca, who is a small business owner, and Jimmy Centers, who is with Cornerstone, to talk about some different bipartisan plan that has come together, a group of a lot of small businesses across the country trying to figure out how to help businesses come out on the other side. So we've got four main areas I want to tackle with you, which are the four main areas of this plan. Jimmy, let's start with you. Talk about what these four main areas of this plan are.
Yeah, the report is from the Bipartisan Policy Center and Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses Voices, which in 2018 launched here in Iowa. And Perla is an alumni of that wonderful program. The four main areas that are identified are workforce and labor, childcare, which plays into that workforce challenge, government procurement or contracting, which Perla is an expert on as a constructor here in the Des Moines area, and then finally access to capital, which is critically important for small business to be able to grow and expand.
Okay, so we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty details of what action you're asking for in order to help these small businesses. But Perla, talk to me a little bit about your story. How did the pandemic impact you and your construction company here in the metro?
Yeah, for us was not an easy 2 years as for all the other small businesses. And we're still trying to come out of it. You know, like construction is facing some issues now with chain supply demand and materials costs going up and fuel. But we are very thankful to the SBA because they were a key in helping small businesses get to this point. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean we are out of the woods. It just means we got to keep doing the work. And some of what we are proposing with that is that can lead us on that direction.
So let's talk about one of those four pillars that you really, Perla, you are the expert in, which is procuring contracts with the federal government. Small businesses, I mean, it's a heavy lift to get those contracts, to even be able to apply for the contract.
Yeah, it's not easy, and I think it's important that we modernize a little bit of the relationship between the agencies and the small business because it's so hard to get in. Once you are in, it's still hard to perform the projects and everything, but I think if we're better prepared before we go in, mm-hmm. we can be successful.
Okay, so how do we do it? What are the policy proposals out there from the bipartisan policy?
Well, first and foremost, we think it's time for Congress to reauthorize the Small Business Administration. Mm-hmm. Congress, the state of Iowa, the Small Business Administration did an exceptional job helping small businesses during the pandemic. But we think coming out of it now, there are more things that can be done. We can modernize and revitalize the Small Business Administration. I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that the SBA has not been reauthorized by Congress since the year 2000. If we just think about how much our economy has changed in 22 years, I think we can all agree that the time is now to reimagine and reinvigorate the agency, especially as small business owners like Perla come out of this pandemic.
I didn't realize that it hadn't been reauthorized, I guess. You know, that's something that as I was reading this report, I said, what? They do so much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you think about it, in the year 2000, when we said Amazon, most of us mm-hmm. thought of either a rainforest or an online bookstore. None of us were using an iPhone to buy and purchase goods because the iPhone wouldn't be introduced for 7 more years. So much about our world, our economy has changed since then. It's time for Congress to take a fresh look at the SBA.
Perla, what do you want people who are sitting at home, who might not be a small business owner, to understand about the issues small business owners have faced and how what needs to be done in order to allow our economy to continue to grow?
I mean, when it comes to the reauthorization of the SBA, I think that's key. You know, all the business, even if you're not a small business owner, you got to agree that we are the backbone of the economy. Mm-hmm. So what we have now is new challenges. And in order to solve them, we need new solutions. We can't keep using solutions of 20 years ago. So I think it's important that our report gets to the Congress and they take a look at it, mm-hmm. so we can really, the needs that we have now can be attended.
Absolutely. So where can someone find this report? And, you know, what are the next steps in making sure that some of these policy proposals actually get considered?
Yeah, so you could find the report online either through the Bipartisan Policy Center or through Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses online. In terms of the next steps, we would ask Congress to consider reauthorizing the SBA. We understand they have a lot on their plates mm-hmm. right now, and they did do an exceptional job, particularly with PPP and COVID EIDL to help small businesses. But it is time to reimagine how the SBA services small businesses, especially in those four key areas: childcare, workforce, access to capital, and government procurement.
Okay, so we're gonna also link that report on our website, weareiowa.com. So Perla, Jimmy, thank you so much for your time this morning. And
thank
of course,
you.
I think we'll, and we would love to continue to follow this conversation as maybe you continue to approach our members of Congress to reauthorize the SBA.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a short break. Coming up on This Week in Iowa, following a deadly shooting outside East High School in Des Moines, we turn our attention to prevention. An expert on school funding joins us next. A shooting outside East High School in Des Moines on March 7th killed a 15-year-old boy, Jose David Lopez. Two teen girls are still in the hospital recovering. Court documents show it was a planned, coordinated attack. Multiple vehicles circling the school, 35 shots fired, 6 guns recovered from the vehicles. Police say it is gang impacted. 6 teens have been charged with murder and attempted murder, and 4 of those teens are being charged as adults. 17-year-old Octavio Lopez Sanchez, 17-year-old Henry Valladares Amaya, 17-year-old Romeo Perdomo, and 16-year-old Manuel Bueso. This is a conversation that has many asking, how do we stop this from happening again? And many officials who I've spoken to say it comes down to preventing violence and offering social services to at-risk youth. But those services come at a cost. So we are joined now by Margaret Buckton, who is with Iowa School Finance, to talk about how schools with the high at-risk population can afford to offer these additional services. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Sabrina. I appreciate the opportunity to help people understand this.
And so to get started, can you kind of paint a picture for school funding in Iowa?
Sure. So Iowa school funding is driven by a formula, and that formula is based on a combination of state money and local property taxes. And it's truly reflective of the enrollment of the school district. So in October 1 of every fall, schools count their students, and that is multiplied by the state cost per pupil to give them their budget. So last October 1, the students were counted. They're preparing the budgets for starting school this July 1st based on that state cost per pupil, and then legislative action, which also will apply a cost multiplier or the state supplemental assistance to that particular rate.
Okay, so what issues do you see that schools with a higher percentage of students who are on free and reduced lunch, or maybe they're more at risk, what do those schools with that higher population face?
Sure. So they have all kinds of services that they could provide if they had adequate funding. And they're things that would encourage engagement of students earlier in the process, middle school activities, helping kids find their passion. That takes a little bit more adult involvement when students don't have as much supports at home. Things from different curriculum to reading, you know, recovering their lost reading skills or catching up when they're behind. And we've seen an increase in mental health challenges since the pandemic, but we were sure seeing that over the last 10 years. So do we have social workers and counselors and mental health supports or the ability to connect the students to those supports in the community?
And you're saying these are issues that the at-risk youth face much more than those who perhaps have a heavy parental support at home.
Right, right. And it's not just parental support. It's you know, access to quality insurance. It's making sure that they have, you know, their tummy's full when they come to school in the morning. It's making sure they have a safe place to go after school if all of the parents in their home are working. So those kinds of things really are needs for that at-risk population. But that population has changed in Iowa. So when we look back to 2001, we had about 26-27% of Iowa's public school students eligible for free and reduced price lunch, and that's grown to 41-42% in the last several years. So we've got, you know, a lot more students who are coming from those low-income families, but in urban centers like Des Moines, that is really concentrated. In Des Moines, we're over 75% of the students eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So if you take that kindergarten class of 25 students and you count every one of them going down the line to go to lunch, you're going to have two or three students in that class that are not in that low-income family.
So there are kind of two areas here to look at. First is the formula, how we decide how much per pupil funding there is. And then the second is that per pupil dollar amount. So let's start with the formula.
Sure.
There have been explorations of changing this. How would you propose it is changed?
Sure. So Iowa is kind of an outlier. Most states have already had these conversations of how students who are at risk of dropping out, at risk of not being successful to grade level in reading or math, just at risk of those challenges that they may face with lack of supports at home. And so many states have in their formula a calculator or a weighting associated with poverty. Iowa doesn't currently have that. If the national average is 29% more funding for those low-income students, Iowa doesn't have that. So our schools that have a concentration of those students really don't have any kind of a resource to pay for the extra services that are required to help those students be educated to success.
And while we often hear that it's a big, maybe a Democrat-heavy topic to say schools need more funding, there was a consideration a couple years ago to change this weighting, at least, if not give more funding, and that was a bipartisan Republican-led change.
Right.
Or so, proposal.
Yeah, so every 5 years our legislature convenes a committee over the interim, a school finance study committee, and they look at our formula and all those weightings and what's happened. And, you know, recently out of those committees, the last two or three iterations, they've decided transportation funding needed to be handled, and they've done that. And they decided that the formula equity had to be closer, that all districts needed the same cost per pupil. And they've made inroads to that. In this last school finance interim committee, which was December of 2019, they had a unanimous support that Iowa should study poverty factors in other states and determine what kinds of services were necessary to provide supports to at-risk populations. And not all students in poverty need this, right? And not all poverty is equal, but across the nation, that's the measure that they use to determine that some schools may require more funding.
Okay, Margaret, but that stalled.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to talk about school funding here in just a few minutes, but we're going to switch gears and talk about that other factor. We're going to talk about the school per pupil funding. So stay with us, everyone. We'll talk about more of what's happening under the Golden Dome, as well as some other proposals being explored after this. We continue our discussion this morning with Margaret Buckton with Iowa School Finance. So we talked about kind of that equation, how money is decided, how much money goes to each student. But now let's talk about the actual dollar amount, the per pupil funding. This year we saw a 2.5% increase from the legislature. But you are saying, Margaret, that's not enough. Let's talk about the history, where Iowa's been, where we are now, and maybe what the future holds.
Sure. This funding formula was created back in the mid-70s. And for the first 15 years, 20 years of the formula, there was an automatic pilot. It looked at things like inflation rate and the valuation growth of property and automatically spit out what that factor should increase per student. In the mid-90s, it was taken off that automatic pilot and became a legislative decision. So now our legislature convenes and they determine the percent that number is going to go up. In the last decade, it's averaged 1.8%. When I call it our cost of doing the business of school, the inflation factor for schools to handle their salary schedules and absorb the cost of insurance benefits and pay for transportation and materials, all of that has been around 3 to 3.5%. Well, this last year, inflation is even higher, right? It's 7.5. So the 2.5% increase in the cost per student is not sufficient to maintain the same level of staffing. That's assuming your student enrollment is the same. If you have a decline in enrollment, you actually are cutting your budget and probably having to consider which staff aren't going to be there next year.
Something we know Des Moines Public Schools is going through right now.
Right.
So talk to me about how much money you think, or what you think the solution is for that per pupil funding.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to look at that per pupil funding as a measure compared to other economic factors. And much of the rhetoric around the 2.5% is we've increased funding by millions of dollars, $407 million since 2018, that's a lot of money. And Iowans look at that and say, yeah, that's a lot of money. But the money that's actually getting to the classroom, because the mix of funding in the state is less than that. They've used about a third of that, $122 million of that $407 million increase has been a shift from property taxes to state aid. So that's great for property taxpayers, but for students, for education decision makers, they're still having to balance the budget with what doesn't appear to be as much money as what the rhetoric would say.
So it's just, as you said yesterday in our conversation prior to this, you know, taking a penny out of one pocket and just putting it in another.
Right. Right. So how do we take a step back from the emotion and say, what do we compare this to? So the first thing I look at is what other states are doing. We spend about $1,208 less per student than the national average. And then when you think our prior conversation, that 29% waiting for poverty would be even less than what other states are doing, right? When you look at it compared to gross domestic product in the state or per capita personal income, it's not keeping up with those either. And of course, that inflation rate is 7.5%. Schools are going to have some tough decisions to make come this fall.
Now, I do have two topics I want to make sure we get to, and we only have about a minute and a half left,
okay.
So bear with me real quick.
Sure.
I would be remiss not to bring up the situation with the superintendent, mm-hmm. Tom Ahart, who is leaving a year before his contract ends, but he's being paid through the end of his contract. That's to the tune of like $400,000. That's about 9 starting teacher salaries.
Right.
We're asking, Des Moines Public Schools asking for more funding, meanwhile doing this. Can you square that for me?
Sure. So most people don't know, the average tenure of a superintendent in the nation is 4 to 6 years. For an urban superintendent, it's 3.2 years. So Dr. Ahart was a superintendent in Des Moines for over a decade, and when they have contractual agreements to mutually discontinue, which is what this contract said, both the school board and the former employee benefit. So the school board is getting protection from litigation, Dr. Ahart's cooperation if they are sued on something else. And frankly, he was following the direction of the school board in many of the more controversial things that put Des Moines kind of in the crosshairs with the legislature. So figuring out how you have a separation that's mutually beneficial, but also lets the next superintendent coming in know that the school board's going to consider their needs is really important, more for recruiting the next leader for the Des Moines Public Schools.
And Margaret, I really wanted to talk about school vouchers and the impact that that will have, but unfortunately we are out of time. So we will have to have you come back another time to talk about what school vouchers could do for the public school system.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Okay, we'll take a short break. It's official now. Deirdre Dejere is running to become Iowa's next governor. Although she announced last August, this week she filed the paperwork needed to make her candidacy official. And she is the only Democrat running after Representative Ross Smith out of Waterloo dropped out.
Now is the time that we remind ourselves that we can do hard things. This race is not going to be easy, and I'm setting out on a path to remind people that we can do this. We're talking about policy. We're talking about the changes. We're acknowledging the challenges that people are facing, but we're also empowering them to do something about it.
Dejere seemingly faces an uphill battle against current Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. A recent Des Moines Register MediaCom poll has Reynolds up by 8 points. The United States Senate has unanimously voted to make daylight saving time permanent, giving us an extra hour of light in the evening year-round. That bill would go into effect beginning in 2023. The U.S. House would have to approve it as well, and then, of course, President Biden would have to sign it into law. A hearing in the House last week showed overall approval of the idea. Now, here locally, it's a proposal on the state level that would actually keep us on daylight saving time pending federal action, meaning we would not fall back in autumn if this passes, therefore never needing to spring forward again, and we would not spring forward for one final time next year when the rest of the country does. Again, if this all passes. The bill was proposed in the Iowa House by Republican Mike Sexton. He's been working on legislation like this over the last couple years. He says initially constituents wrote a letter asking for the elimination of the time change, and then he started to look into the possible elimination and found studies that pointed to how it impacts certain groups of people. This measure has passed the House. It's eligible for debate in the full Senate. If it passes, the state would need the federal government to approve changes to daylight saving time. Well, this week, we also got a bit of a surprise at the State House. A bill before the House State Government Committee focused on licenses for barbers. But an amendment that lawmakers added at the last second changed the pace of this legislation. It really had nothing to do with cosmetology. Instead, it prevents pipeline companies from using eminent domain over private property owners for the next 1 year. Committee Chair Republican Bobby Kaufman introduced the amendment to allow negotiations between pipeline companies and homeowners to continue without the threat of eminent domain. Democrats, however, raised some concern over the method Kaufman is using and saying it didn't last long enough.
But this, to me, was the best compromise that I can come up with to ensure that landowners have the certainty that they need and have been asking for when we're gone. Because everybody knows things change when sine die happens before we come back again in January.
I have great concerns. I don't think this is the right vehicle for it. And I also don't think this language addresses the concerns that we have ongoing.
If this legislation passes, it would mean that pipeline companies would not be able to use eminent domain against private property owners from now until March of 2023. You're watching This Week in Iowa. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for joining us here for This Week in Iowa. Of course, we'll have that report that we talked about here earlier in the show on our website, weareiowa.com. And you can always find us on a podcast. You can find us on Spotify or wherever you find the podcast that you listen to. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a great rest of your weekend, everyone.